You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Alrighty, welcome to the Celtics Lab podcast brought to you by FanDuel, the exclusive wagering partner of the CLNS Media Network. I am Cameron Teptabai. I'm joined by Alex Goldberg and Dr. Justin Quinn. Justin apologizes in advance for choppy internet down in Mexico City. It's not quite the dog days of the offseason yet, but we're pretty much there. And so we thought we'd bring in a special guest to talk about, yes, what's going on with the Celtics, but also kind of how the sausage gets made. So we invited in Gary Washburn of the Boston Globe and the A-List podcast. Gary, how are you?
Great, guys. Good to be here. I've watched some of your podcasts, so good stuff. So
likewise.
It was a little shocked to get the invitation, but appreciate it.
This is the big leagues, Gary. Welcome.
Wow.
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll go through the news. There's some stuff, like I just said. And then really, Gary, it's not just that you know how to break a story, but you know how to break kind of delicate stories in the world of sports. Some journalists either don't care to or prefer not to talk about the off the court stuff, but you do that and you do that well. So we're going to talk to you about what that looks like. But first, because that's not everyone's cup of tea, we'll just go around the dial talking about some news stuff. And Gary, just off the jump, where are you at with the Celtics offseason? There's been a lot of movement. I'm sure you've talked about it. You've written about it. But kind of what's your summary on how you feel about this offseason?
Obviously, I think they kind of made a huge save by signing Jalen and getting some good publicity at the end of the month. The Marcus thing, I think, is still out. The jury's still out on that. I do think they had to make some changes. I don't know if they could have ran the same team back next year and it's just expected different results, or expected Mazzulla just to get better, or expected the new coaching staff just to have a great impact. I think the Marcus move was as much about maybe off court and model citizen, nothing to do with that, but like,
yeah,
his impact, his leadership, maybe hovering a little too much and allowing Jalen and Jason to be freer and just kind of seeing what it's like to go a different direction. And that's not to blame Marcus for anything that's happened over the last 7-8 years in terms of failing to reach the finals and then failing to win the finals in 2022. But I think they knew someone had to go. And then obviously the Brogdon thing wasn't going to work salary wise. Something had to give. And Memphis has been really hot on Marcus for a few years now. And so I just think they felt like they needed to add a wrinkle to the offense with Porzingis. The Grant thing, I think, will hurt. I think Grant really wanted to come back, but kind of came to the realization it wasn't going to happen. The Celtics, I felt like, think like O'Shea Brissett might be able to fill in that role. And he's more athletic and he's hungry. He's 25, so the same age as Grant. Maybe a bigger opportunity. He didn't have a great year last year in Indiana. He had a good year the year before. So I think they felt like we can get kind of a Grant for cheaper money. We don't want to pay $13 million per year for Grant services. We'd rather pay $2.5 million for Brissett and maybe take the hit and hope that other guys respond, like Hauser. Let's hope, you know, Brogdon has a good year and a healthy year. Derek White takes another step forward. Maybe they add someone on a minimum contract. They have 17 players under contract. So I feel like it's a C-plus with the You know, I still am not sure about Derek White at point guard. That's something I'm really concerned about. Nothing against Derek, but Derek's not a guy who's great under pressure. I think he was allowed to relax last year, and he filled a role because there was not many expectations. Now he's running the offense. You know, he's going to try to get the ball past Pat Bev and other, you know, fiery defenders are going to try to get in his head. Like, I'm a little concerned about that. I would have probably been more comfortable if Brogdon was running point and moving back to the role he had in Milwaukee in his early days in Indiana. But we'll see what happens with that. Maybe it's a great idea. Maybe it works amazingly. But I think that they need another point guard. And then kind of putting Pritchard into this role of, we don't need you, we don't need you, we don't need you, now we need you. I don't know what that does to his head. And I think him playing for the USA Select team is a really good decision. I think that's really going to help him. But he spent last year wanting out. And now you've got – and Joe didn't particularly like him. But now suddenly he's going to be a real asset. And then you've got to talk Malcolm off the ledge in terms of like, yeah, we're really about to trade you. And now welcome back, you know, you've – and, you know, here's a starting slot in the backcourt if that's the case. Or here's, you know, revise your sixth man of the year role and get over it. And I think Malcolm's professional enough to do that. He's 30, so he's not a young man anymore. He's not probably as emotional, but I'm sure he was. He's not feeling good about what happened and the fact that Mazzulla kind of acknowledged that there's definitely needs to be conversations with him and it hasn't been resolved, I think is a concern. So at this point, I give it a CC+. Signing Jalen was a solid move. It had to happen. You got to get over the $304 million because it's going to – I mean, I think Wembanyama is going to be the first half-billion-dollar player. So we're heading toward that. Like, the spaceship is soaring to like, the first – someone's going to sign the five-year, $500 million deal. It's coming in the next 7 to 8 years or 5 to 6 years. So let's see what happens when Miyama's rookie deals up or sorry, he goes into that third contract, like, you know, like Jalen just did and Jason's about to do. I still think they need some reinforcements. I think they need a tough guy. I think they need a guy who's like, they need a veteran. If it's Blake, I mean, I just don't like the mentality that you don't ever want to take any chances on a guy. Like, I don't like the, well, we don't want DeMarcus Cousins because, like, you need a tough guy. You need a guy to lay some hat. You need intensity. Basically, Gabe Vincent called him out and was just like, they're bitching at each other. They're not, like, the soft reputation is still there. Miami out-toughed them, right? Miami's a tougher team.
And now Marcus and Grant, who...
With Marcus and Grant, now you've lost your toughest guy and a guy who's not backing down from anybody. And I had no problem with what he said to Jimmy Butler. I hate the poke the bear scenario and that I hated that because, you know, I hated that nobody came to his defense. And as I've talked with Cedric Maxwell over the years, I need to see Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown like get in somebody's face and say, hey, man, don't fucking foul me like that. Excuse my language. Don't foul me like that. Don't do that. Yeah. I need to see some toughness out of those two.
Jaylen, got a little bit of that from Jaylen.
Jaylen, a little bit. Jason still, like, I guess he doesn't want it to people to see that they get under his skin, but he's got to be an MF out there now. Like, he's not 19 anymore. I think he's 25, be 26 next year. If he wants to win MVP, if he wants to lead his team to the finals, Jason needs to be an MF, like, every night, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he's MF most of the nights, but he's got to be more vocal. He's got to get in people's faces. He's got to be the leader of this franchise. So, given all that uncertainty, I can't give him anything more than, like, a C+. And I like Porzingis. When he's healthy, I think that 32-13-6 game he had against the Celtics in April did probably got him to Boston. But he's got to play. He's got to play a lot. And then we'll see what happens. I think Robert Williams, they need more out of him. Like, he's got to develop a damn post move. Like, yeah. Robert, develop. You've been in the league 5 years now, man. Go to, and it looks like he is working on his game. And we all seen the videos, although the off-season workout videos are probably the most annoying aspect of covering the NBA is the, oh, he's in great shape. Oh, he's looking good. Oh, he's hitting, you know, 200 threes a day. Like, whatever, man. Like, but I need to see more from Robert Williams. I'm not sure what to expect from Horford at age 37. I don't think they should expect as much as they got. I think he got off to a really good start, that he got tired of the season ended, and now they've got him for two more years, so they're going to figure something out. So there's a lot of uncertainties in this team. It could all work out great, but I think they need some more reinforcements.
Quick question for you related to that. So you mentioned that the coaching staff was bolstered and that, you know, obviously they brought in Charles Lee and Sam Cassell. Gary, you've been with the team for a while now, and you were here when Sam Cassell was in the building. And so I guess my question is, knowing what you know, just as a reporter, you know, having been around Sam Cassell, what does he bring as far as a hire goes to this team, just from your perspective?
Well, I think what this staff has missed, I think they had it with Jerome Allen, right? Mm-hmm. But he was a Brad guy. So when he took over, he was gone. He went to Detroit. They need a guy who played the game. They need a guy relatively young. Now, Cassell's 53, but he's more of a big brother than he is a father, right? They need, I think Cassell will keep it real. I think he has a passion for the Celtics. I think that he's been around the block. He's been an assistant for 15 years now. Like, I think he jumped into coaching right after he retired. He's won three championships. He's exactly what the Celtics needed, didn't have last year. Like,
get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It was a complete disservice for Brad not to help out. Brad did Joe no favors last year. Mm-hmm. Absolutely none. You didn't hire any assistants to replace. You didn't hire another coach to replace Ime. You didn't hire a coach. You know, you could add a woman coach. Like, you know, you lost Carol Austin a few years ago. You need a different perspective. You could have, you know, there's nothing wrong with a female coach. It's nothing wrong right. with adding in the middle of the season. It's nothing wrong. There's 20 guys out here who can't wait to get out of the house, who know NBA ball, former coaches that you could have added to that staff mid-season when Stoudemire left, that could have enhanced and helped Joe out. You left Joe on an island with guys who weren't his guys. And you saw the minute, I mean, I knew they were leaving during the playoffs. Everybody knew. Everybody knew when Ime got that Houston job, everybody knew that Miles not. Now, Miles went to New Orleans. He didn't go to Houston. My man, I like Mike Moser, a good rising young coach. And then Sullivan, everybody knew they were gone. So what does that say? So I think Cassell adds stability, and so is Charles Lee. So I think it's really important that happened and that Joe signed off. And what hurts Joe is that he might not have a lot of friends around the league because he's new. He just joined in 19. He never coached in the NBA before he got to Boston. He coached D2. So his guys are more college guys, right? So the fact that he's developed a relationship and that Cassell is signed on. Now, could Cassell replace him if they start 10-18? Of course he could. The same with Charles Lee. Both of them are looking to be head coaches. But that's the chances you got to freaking take. Like, you got to enhance your staff. That staff last year, a bunch of nice guys, but when Stoudemire left, it was not the same. Stoudemire filled that old head role, that the former NBA player, that's really important to these guys. And Cassell has the resume. They know it. They've seen it, right? They've seen him in the Celtics. They know he won. Now they weren't born then, Jason and Jalen. They saw him win titles in 94 and 95 with the Rockets, so they can watch on YouTube or NBA TV. So I think that was a critical hire to get him. I think Brad was very well aware that he dropped the ball on not helping Joe and that coaching staff during last year.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you know Joe way better than I do, but as much as maybe he was a little inflexible with some of his strategies, he seems like such a let's do this as a community kind of guy that I think he would have taken help. I think he would have taken a mentor. Maybe he would have taken a little bit of extra finagling to get him to sign on to some new messaging, but he doesn't strike me as a tyrant. I mean, he is constantly, you know, taking blame for things going wrong and then shining a light on things that he did pretty well elsewhere. So yeah, I don't know. I agree with that entirely. Also, Gary, to your point, I think that the Tatum needs to, he's a very emotional guy after games, right? When they win, he's really happy. And when they lose, you could see he's a little more quiet. And so I do wonder if he's trying to protect himself during the game. And I'd love to see him, you know, take that emotion and actually gear it towards something other than, you know, the post-game press conference. Because when the emotion shows up there, it's useless.
Well, I think with Jason, okay, Jason, when he came into the league, was very robotic. He was very Duke. He was very, like, he was afraid of his own shadow, okay? He has broken out of that, okay? All the marketing, he's on. Yeah, you guys ever remember, y'all ever see the movie Celtic Pride?
Yeah.
Okay, and when they kidnapped Damon Wayans and they said, if there's no commercials on that he's on for 10 minutes, they'll let him go. not Dan Aykroyd. God, it was Dan Aykroyd and the other guy.
I blocked that movie out of my consciousness.
Okay, it was a bad movie, but if you haven't seen it, it's absurdly hilarious because Damon Wayans plays this kind of Karl Malone type superstar playing for the Utah Jazz. They kidnap him before a big game against the Celtics. So they say, if we could watch television and not see your commercial, any commercial for 10 minutes, then we'll let you go. And of course, like after 8 minutes, there's a commercial with like him doing like Nutter Butters or something, right? So I just feel like that way about Jason. Like Subway, Gatorade, like everything is Jason. So he's broken out of his shell. Like he's become a great endorser. He has fun. He enjoys his life. He loves his son and his family. Great. But leadership needs to be the next responsibility. He's living the NBA life and he enjoys it, you know? He's making great money. He's going to make $320 million in about 12 months. Life is wonderful. And he seems to, you know, he's not in any trouble, doesn't do anything off the floor. But it's now time for Jason to translate that to being a leader of the franchise. Not the best player, but the leader. And I think the Marcus void has to force that to happen. Because I think maybe there was a perception that Marcus was just too much influence over that organization, too much influence over the franchise. Marcus was not held accountable for bad shots. He did whatever the hell he wanted to do because you knew eventually he was going to make a great play, game-saving play, but there was that step-back three-pointer in Game 7 against Miami. There was the foul against Trae Young in game 5 when they could have closed out that series. There was the sequence in Game 7 in 22 against Miami where they're up, 16? And then Marcus decided he was going to, like, bring it on home, and Miami went on, like, a 13-0 run or whatever, a 14-2 run or whatever to set up Jimmy Butler's missed three. Like, that was all Marcus. Like, Marcus was like, I'm bringing this home, baby. Like, this is me. I'm going to put my fingerprint. And then it just almost fell apart. So I think that now Jason has to like take a next step off mentally. And I think this is a critical season for him. Obviously he's going to get paid. It's not financially critical because whatever happens, he's going to get paid and he's going to get max. It ain't gonna be no Jalen drama. Like, ain't gonna be no freaking trade kickers and fighting over, you know, player option. Jason will probably demand a player option after year four. The Celtics will have to give him that or whatever. But this ain't gonna be the suspense and the drama that Jalen's was. Jason's gonna get a 329 or whatever it is, right? But Jason he's a top 10 player. You want to be a top three player, and that spot, their spot's open. You know, mm-hmm. LeBron has dropped, so it's Jokic. It is Embiid. Sorry, not I mean, we'll say Embiid, Giannis, and maybe Embiid. Maybe, you know, you think
Steph Embiid? Curry might have.
Oh, yeah, Curry. So there's some spots open. There's some debate to be had. So Jason has to take that step forward off the floor in leadership, and then take that step on the floor in terms of being like MVP caliber.
Yeah, I love juxtaposing Jalen and Jason, because Jalen, you know, does Red Bull and then like MIT Media Lab, and then Jason does like Ruffles and NBA 2K. I mean, the things that they put their names behind, no value judgment whatsoever, but they're very different. No, I agree entirely. I mean, I think they're both two young men who are stepping into their prime. We've said a lot in this podcast that you're just more put together when you're 26, 27 than when you're 22 or 23. So hopefully, you know, that bears out with the Jays. All right. A few more things, Gary, in the world of news. And then we're going to talk about how you break stories and specifically talk about things that are more difficult to talk about. So we would be remiss if we didn't make mention that this is going to be Mike Gorman's last season, or at the very least, he suspects it's going to be his last season. There's going to be a lot of ink and a lot of podcasting spilled and conducted about Gorman in the coming year. But just quickly, do you have a good Mike Gorman story? Do you remember when you first met him or anything like that? Again, we have all year to do this, but just give us one good Mike Gorman story.
Honestly, my perspective of Mike Gorman is way different because I grew up on the West Coast. I grew up in Los Angeles. Right. And I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember Big Monday, ESPN's like college basketball. Okay, so you guys are like, no.
Is this when he used to do the Big East games?
Yes. Okay. In the 80s, when I was in high school. So that's how I got to know Mike Gorman. It had nothing to do with the Celtics. Like, in those days, like, you know, regional television was real regional. Like, there was no league pass or anything like that. So you could not watch Celtics at Hawks on a Wednesday night unless it was like on TNT national, unless it was a national game, right? It was like league pass did not exist. I know young people are like, what? there was a world before league pass. Yes, there was, right? So regional television, like, I had no clue. I'd never, you know, you would only hear him on bits and pieces of highlights of him doing with Tommy on Celtics. So I always used to tell Mike, and I still tell him, like, he has no idea the reach that he had, because on the West Coast, we all grew up on Big East basketball. That's why in the 80s and the 90s, there was this humongous, like, pillage, transformation, migration of West Coast basketball players east, because they would say, well, I could either play, I just watched Syracuse, Pittsburgh in front of a crowded Pittsburgh arena or whatever, Pittsburgh Civic Center, or I could go watch, or I could play, and I just watched Washington State at UCLA. Like, hell no. Where am I? What's the best atmosphere? It's the Big East. So Gorman was like, Gorman helped recruit tons of kids from the West Coast and LA by just doing the Big East games, right? Because when we got home from schools, it was like 4 o'clock. So the big game, the first game, and I grew up in the West Coast, so I'm used to West Coast times, although I've been in the East a long time now. The 4 o'clock game, like, that we would, that's the game, that was a Big East game. And then, like, I think it was, might have been like the 7 o'clock game, might have been, or so the 6 o'clock game might have been like SEC or Big Ten or something like that. Probably, I think it was Big Ten. So it was like Illinois, Indiana. That didn't really make a big difference, although some kids went off to Big Ten schools. But Mike Gorman, as the voice of the Big East, I think is completely underrated, because that popular, that made that conference extremely popular. And those games are all wars. And so it was just awesome to hear Gorman and then to meet him when I came here in 09 and be like, you know, and just tell him that. Because they're, oh, he's been with the Celtics since 79. I was like, yeah, don't relate to that. But I do relate to hearing him on Big East, you know, Big East basketball with Vitale or I forgot whoever was like color analyst or whatever, Raftery or whatever. I mean, that's what I grew up on Gorman. That's my special memories of Gorman is like whatever, St. John's at, you know, Villanova and Georgetown at BC. I mean, you know, Providence. It was just like, yeah, UConn. I don't know how that came to my head suddenly, but UConn. And the funny thing is that helped a lot of kids from LA. Like, that's why the Pac-12, well, that's, you know, one of the reasons why the Pac-12 is like disintegrating as we speak. But another reason why the Pac-12 in the 70s was this powerful conference, in the 80s it lost all of its luster because the best kids said, I want to play at Madison Square Garden. I want to play at Boston Garden. I want to play at the Spectrum. You know, I want to play in these places. I want to, like, what, like, I don't want to play at, you know, Frio Court in Pullman, Washington. Like, I want to play in the Big East. So Gorman, with his descriptions of those games and obviously the games itself, helped pull a lot of West Coast kids east. And it was just, that's what we grew up on. It was just that kind of basketball.
Okay, I got a couple of things to say. First, Justin, I was politely going to wait to say hail to Pitt. I also come from a former Big East team. Second, I think I've said this a bunch of times on this podcast, Requiem for a Big East continues to be my favorite 30 for 30. So just while we're on the topic, people should check that out. And Gary, what I liked about that was you have to play it cool when you are a young person covering the NBA. And so I'll embarrass you a little bit. You know, you're someone I look up to. There's a whole suite of NBA writers that I really look up to. But when you're in the halls of TD Garden, there's always a bigger fish. Because, you know, maybe I'm looking up to you, and then you're looking up to Mike, and Mike's looking up to Satch when he comes through or whatever. Like, there's just such a chain of influence and like inspirational voices and people walking down the back halls. It's so fun. So that I like that story a lot. Okay, a few more news things, and then let's get into what we call the Celtics Lab. The World Cup, FIBA World Cup, is going to kick off shortly enough. Al Horford is playing for the Dominican. Porzingis is playing for Latvia, and Brissett is playing for Canada, which is a pretty stacked team.
They're really trying to go to the Olympics. Like, like, it's been too long in Canada. Team Canada, I think last time they lost to Venezuela, like in the qualifier to make it to Japan. So I think they're pulling everybody. They've got a great deal of talent, but none of them have all played together. So it's just fascinating to see how really desperately Canada wants to get to the Paris games, because it's kind of sad with all the talent since the Vince Carter generation has brought all this talent from Canada. They've yet to qualify. They haven't qualified for the Olympics, I think, since 2000. So, or 96 or 2000, one of them. So it's pretty sad. But it's, I guess you could root for them because, I mean, you know, it's just been too long coming. And I said, I remember like they lost to, I want to say it was Venezuela, in like overtime, like four or five.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, like they lost to Venezuela, and, you know, and not like nothing against Venezuela, but they don't have any NBA players. And so for them to lose to Venezuela for a chance to reach Japan in the Olympics. So, yeah, I'm not surprised Brissett got drawn in to playing for Team Canada.
I mean, good for him. It's good exposure to your point. It's a pretty solid team. I'm just excited. You know, it's in East Asia. It's predominantly in the Philippines. So you like wake up to high level basketball games. This is going to be fun. I'm not going to say anything about injuries or jinxing or anything like that. Let's just keep it moving. How's that? Okay. One last thing. I just want to shout out my guy, Bobby Krivitsky at SI. He talked to Dwayne Wade, and Dwayne Wade had a really glowing review of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. So if you haven't, go check that out. And shout out to my friend, Bobby. Okay. Gary. Sports are easy enough to talk about. The ball either went in the hoop or it didn't. But it's also, you know, a reflection of our society and people who think sports aren't politics. I think they have that wrong. let's respect some people want to use sports as an escape. That's a really privileged position. But if that's your case, you know, you can check out. Thanks for listening, like, and subscribe. But we want to talk to you about covering sports with multiple lenses, because we're more interested in that. You've got two history teachers and a PhD in anthropology on the call. So obviously we're going to gravitate towards that. And as best we can tell, you do it better than most when it comes to race, when it comes to politics, when it comes to things that can be difficult, not just to communicate and write about, but also strike a chord with an audience, because not all sports fans want to talk about that stuff or read that stuff. Has that always been an interest of yours, you know, as pursuing a sports journalism career? And how do you approach speaking truth to power in that way? Like, how do you pick up that kind of story? How do you advocate for telling that story, either with the Globe or on the podcast? Like, where in you is that coming from? And like, what does that process look like?
I think that journalism has changed considerably over the last 20 years. And I think that the point of journalism is to tell a story. The point of journalism is to get to know people. My biggest issue with young journalists is they don't talk to anybody. Like, they're afraid to talk to someone outside their box. And that means, you know, being 25 and you might have to get to know Danny Ainge. You might have to get to know Brad. Brad's a little different. He's a little younger. The first coach I covered as a professional when I covered the NBA was Bill Fitch. And that was 1996. I was young, and Bill had better days. He was coaching the Los Angeles Clippers. He was trying to finish it out. He was in a dead-end job. The Clippers, I mean, it's I would love to hear the impressions of young people about the Clippers, because it's Kawhi and Paul and CP3 and Lob City. Like, nah, man. This was the worst sports franchise in professional sports, right? And they played at the Sports Arena, which it was great when the Lakers played there in 1962 with Jerry West and Elgin Baylor, but this was like 1996, so it was the worst arena in the league. So I had to get to know him, right? And I couldn't be afraid to talk to him. I couldn't be afraid to accept his criticism. I couldn't be afraid for him jumping on me at one-on-ones when he thought I was wrong about something or he read something I wrote. You have to be able to talk to people, and you have to be able to relate to people. And as a journalist, it's your damn job to figure out how to relate to them. My old boss, a guy named Eric Sonheimer, is like this prep guru in LA. He still does prep sports. He would have me call these high school coaches. I cover high school. I start, like, I know people like, what? You cover high school? What is that? Like, you know, kids out of college now, they like, oh, I want to cover the Celtics. And this could be sometimes realistic. But what you don't learn when you jump into professional sports is how to really talk to people and relate to people. So my boss would have me talk to people, call them on Monday nights and just talk about their teams, talk about their players. Not off the record, just talk to them. Now, if they give you something, a nugget, whatever. So that's how I developed the ability to write about things off the field. What's some of your guys going through? What is going on? Oh, my running back, you know, his mom just got over cancer, but she bakes cookies every, you know, Friday for the games. Wow. So, you know, can I go to practice and talk to him? Yeah. You know, that's a great story. And I just think communication is critical. And so at this stage of my career, like, I feel like I should be able to write anything. I have the power to write anything. Thanks to the Globe and the people, the powers that be. I want to inform the readers. I want people who don't read sports to stop and say, okay, I want to read that story. I'm not into fashion. So if you write something too fashionista, like, you're losing me. The same with certain parts of business, you know, the same with certain parts of the sections of the paper or website, like, you're going to lose me. If you get deep into politics and you talk, like, I need it broken down a little bit, basic, so I can understand it and digest it and enjoy it. So I think that that's the one thing that I try to do. And some of the subjects are hard. Some people, but you have to understand too, like, people want to tell you things, like people don't like keeping secrets. So the goal as a journalist is you don't want them to keep secrets. You want them to be comfortable enough to tell you what's going on so you can break stories, so you can write expansive pieces. Because if you know something, Cameron, if you know something juicy, right? Like, it's great to hold it in and confide it, but it's better when you tell someone because you want to see the reaction and be like, what? Mm-hmm. No. Like, that's a power that people like to have. No one likes to keep secrets. That's not an enjoyable skill. It's a skill, but no one likes to keep secrets. Not my wife. I tell my wife things and she just blabs to people. And I'm just like, did you really say I thought that was confidential? Like, no. Right. There's a few things that she said that I just like, I can't believe you. Like, I thought that was between us. It's not. Or I have to like preface it. Do not tell anyone what I'm about to say or how I feel. So to me, it's a matter of people skills. This job is people skills. Speaking to people. Hello, how are you? How are you doing? You know, I mean, Cameron, you're part of, like, it bothers the hell out of me when folks don't ask questions in the scrum. Mm-hmm. The guys get the first row seats, and I'm just, okay, I don't know who it is. They record it. They never ask a question. Why sit in the front row? Or get a job at a courthouse where you can be a stenographer.
No, I think about that a lot. I mean, quite frankly,
I'm not saying quit the business, but eventually break out of your Joe's not going to punch you. Right. Now, Joe will snap your, you know, bite your head off. But imagine if you covered Greg Popovich. How do you think that would go?
Like, no, Joe's good practice for that, I think.
Yes. You can't be scared of the coach. You can't be scared of players. You can't be scared of if you are scared, you're in the wrong business. And sometimes you've got to ask gutsy questions. Now, if it's a question that's completely inappropriate or it should be for private, you've got to know that. And it's sometimes okay to ask, hey, if you ask someone more veteran, if someone asks me, I have a question. This is not like I pull them aside. Don't ask that in a scrum with cameras, CLNS Media, NBC Sports Boston. Don't do that. That's just not going to help you. You're going to win the battle by getting a good answer that's going to be on SportsCenter, and you're going to lose the war because it's like, I'm not talking to that dude anymore or gal, yep, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Or person. So it's just a people business. It still is. Although I think people jump in for the love of the game, which is admirable. They jump in for the love of the numbers, but this game is way more than numbers. It's just way more than analytics. There's a lot of everyone now in this generation, we're the youngest ones.
Yeah, Gen Z.
Z? Okay. They all have some type of story. Mm-hmm. Okay. My generation, most of us came from two-parent homes, or we knew who our fathers were. If we didn't come from two, I came from one-parent home, but obviously my parents divorced, like I knew my dad and all that. Like, that's not necessarily the case. And I lived with my mother. My mother raised me. Like, that's kind of, you know, stereotypical, right? Nowadays, that's not always the case. People live with their grandparents, their aunts, surrogate parents. Every kid has a pretty fascinating story. It's a matter of finding out. And that's what I do. As I get older and I see the players get younger, you know, you just have to learn how to talk to them. Some things I'm not going to come up and talk to them about hip hop. Like, we don't have the same, like, I'm not going to come up to Jordan Walsh, who was literally born in 2004. Okay. And try to talk to him about something 2000, like way current, that like, that's not me. Like, I'm going to talk to him about Arkansas. I'm going to talk to him about maybe being prep. Like, I'm going to find something, a commonality. It's not going to be hip hop. It's not going to be like sneakers. Like, that's not, I'm a fish out of water. So you have to find your commonality. And then writing about socialist, I think sports and society is like this. When I was at UC Berkeley, I took a class, sports and society, from Harry Edwards 30 years ago. And Like, it's, I mean, that was then. Now, sports and society, social issues is just like hand and, you know, glove. So you have to write about things. You should want to write about things more than like analytics and real shooting percentage and things. That's cool. That's cool stuff for your hardcore analytic readers. But if you want to gain more of an audience, then you can write about things that people can really relate to. And I think that these guys and gals, if you go to WNBA or whatever, or college, they all have stories. It's just finding the stories out, talking to the person, finding a common thread, sometimes talking to their family members, introducing yourself to their family members. If you see them at every game, you know, don't just put your head down and be like, you know, if you, you know, like head, give them a head nod, how you doing? Or just introduce yourself. Like, it's a people business, right? You have to be people. If you want to do this and not talk to people, you're not going to, like, you want to be the silent guy, the silent, like, it's just not going to work, you know? And I know I'm not, I'm a shy person. You ask anybody who knows me growing up, shy, I just pick and choose my moments. I'm not one of those people that want to walk in and work the room. I'm not people that are going to act like I know somebody when I don't. I'm not going to, you know, say something out, you know, like I will be calculated in how I approach people. But I think that to be good at this, you have to understand that, like, it's about relationships. And also breaking stories or covering the social issues should be part of it. Because we're all human beings. Like, we're all, before I'm a journalist, I'm a person, I care, I watch the news, I watch CNN, I read stories, stuff breaks my heart. I see stuff on, you know, the videos on Twitter and you're like, wow, it's terrible. You see, like, all that stuff, you're human. That's not a basketball fan. That's not like a journalist. That's just, so you want to tell some of those stories. And I think that that's how you get started, and then it becomes a passion.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just wanted to kind of jump off of a point that you said earlier, which is that, you know, I think you offer some really kind of interesting thoughts about what you kind of have to be in order to make it in this profession in sports journalism, and how you have to be able to talk to people. And I think that's all very, like thoughtful and understandable. But I also think that one thing to consider is that the landscape in terms of accessibility has also changed a lot in a very short amount of time, in just like the last 15 years or so, to the point where I think one of the challenges for young sports journalists is just getting a foot in the door, you know, being able to find and talk to the people that you want to talk to.
Well, I don't agree with that, Alex.
Well, so I'd love to hear.
I'll say this. Yeah. If I, like, the Celtics credential everybody, okay? Yeah. Like, they credential everybody. As a young journalist, I could not have gotten, growing up, a credential to the Lakers just saying I write Lakers blog. They'd have been like, what is that? And who? What is your audience? How many people read Lakers blog? And give what is the content? So access, I think, in terms of like relationships, like, you got to work hard. You got to go to practice. You got to catch these guys, maybe not after a game. I don't think, though, I think access has never been better, because now I see guys in the media room. I don't know who they work for. Back then it was the newspapers, the Herald, the Patriot Ledger, Providence, you knew where everybody was from. Now it is Celtic Blog. Now it is CLNS Media. Now it is like places that I've never heard of. And they have a credential. Now, it might not be a season credential, it might be a daily credential, but they are in the room. So you have to take advantage of that opportunity. And, you know, sometimes it's not easy. But I think, and sometimes you know, like, you want to pick and choose your spots. But I'll just say, like, when I was younger, if I came to games and never, ever asked a question, a veteran reporter would come up to me and go, what are you here for? why are you taking all our shit and not contributing anything to the conversation? Are you mute? What's wrong with you? And, you know, like, it was a different generation, right? At different times, but people did not appreciate you showing up every day and just holding your recorder out or having your doing this and then never contributing to the conversation, but yet going on a podcast and speaking for 3 hours. So you like, well, we know you can talk. So present a question. And this doesn't have to be all the time. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to be Anderson Cooper or whatever. You don't have to just fire away questions, but just bring something to the table where people, you are part of the crew that covers this team. If you're at every home game, you know, traveling's different. Economics, totally agree with that. You're part of the crew that covers a team. So contribute. Ask a question. Now, you know, it could be a very specific question, very analytical. Joe loves that stuff. You could ask Jay, you know, but just contribute. And I think that brings along respect. And the players know that. The players see who asks questions and they don't. You don't think they recognize it? They do. They know who knows what. They know how, they know it. They don't say it, they know it. I remember like when I first, Ray Allen knew every, like he knew everybody. Garnett didn't know our, he acted like he didn't know our names. He knew our names. Like they know, right? The players know. But if you, but I don't agree with the like, well, it's hard to get access the last 15 years. I think access is much easier, especially teams like this. Celtics, they credential a lot of people, right? And the credential is your invitation to have an impact on how this team is covered. Do you want to take advantage of it? That's the question. Or do you, you know, and if you're not sure of yourself, write down your question. That's okay. Like I used to do that. I don't do that now. But if you are unsure or you think you're going to stutter or you think like, You think it could be something mental, like, you know, I don't want to affect anybody's mental health or anything, but, you know, I get it. It could be like hard to be like, wow, like all these people are listening and it's live. And like my mother's watching on NBC Sports Boston and she's going to hear me stutter. Like if you build it up like that, you know, like you're doing a piano solo in middle school, I guess you could, you know, I get it. You know, then write down your question. And
it's funny you say that, Gary. I'll be 31 next month. And sometimes, you know, you're waiting to ask a question to someone like Joe Mazzulla, who's quite intense. And I have to talk myself down, like, actually, we're the same age and this is not a big deal. Bull Pat came on and he said something that just really stuck in my side. I bring it up all the time. He said, tell people something they couldn't otherwise know or take them places they couldn't be. And I think about that a lot. At games or even like tweeting during games is like, what is the value add? Like, am I adding a perspective or am I able to draw out a piece of information that someone else couldn't? Because anyone who's sitting at the game could ask, hey, what'd you think of the 3-point shooting? It takes a little bit more. And I think to your point, the players expect so often to be asked, what was up with the shooting? What was going on with the defense? That when you ask them something human, I think that really resonates with them because as much as they love hoops, I mean, more than I could ever understand, and they want to talk about hoops, certainly guys on this Celtics team, but across the league, they have so much more that they want to talk about and say and accomplish. So I think what you are identifying before is a two-way street that it's as much do you want to tell a good story as these are guys who have stories to tell and you just have to know. I think, Alex, I, as someone who's a little bit in between, I have access, Gary, to your point that someone in my position 20 years ago would never have, but we were beforehand talking about a lower level player whose agent is running us through the ringer to try to get him possibly on the podcast. So it's both access has never been greater and the management of players as brands, I think is different than it once was, but no, certainly. I mean, it's funny. One of the reasons I sit up front is just because my microphone never catches the audio, but I always recognize like, oh shit, I just took a primo seat. I better do something with this. Gary, we got a few more in terms of questions about story breaking, then we'll cut you loose. Justin, I know there's a few things you wanted to ask.
Yeah, so for me, Gary, I really appreciate your work in how you have approached some very difficult issues, specifically the Ime Udoka situation, which was, in my mind, just an absolute nightmare of a situation for everybody involved. And coming from this background of anthropology, I'm a little older than the other hosts on this show. I'm in my 40s. And going through the program, getting trained as an anthropologist, we have an infinitely different approach to how we handle sensitive topics. For example, my PhD dissertation was not published for the general public. You had to go to UF and go to the library and request permission because some of the people who I interviewed, if information that they were the behind certain comments, certain interviews that I had, it could endanger some of the members of their family due to local political violence. So they had a radically different than, say, some newsbreakers who have built this culture in NBA journalism of getting information out there as fast as they can, which is fantastic for who's trading who to what team and who did what in the game last night and all that other stuff. But when it comes to sensitive stuff like what we saw happening there, the ethical construct for dealing with that kind of a story seemed like it was kind of mismatched. But you very quickly, in my opinion, found the right tone. And I think you kind of helped guide the coverage of your peers as well to be more sharply in favor of that kind of a perspective. And I just wanted to know more about how you process the ethical aspects of like some of these more difficult stories.
Yeah, I mean, how do I put this? There's nothing new under the sun. Like, Ime Udoka was not the first professional sports coach, okay, head coach to hang out, okay, get it in. He was not the first professional athlete or coach to have an affair, or not even affair, I'll call it affair. She had an affair. Have a relationship with someone who works in the organization that might be considered unethical. That is not the first time this has happened. Okay. I know that it went public and people were shocked, but sports writers like me who have been around a minute, this was not surprised. It was just how it all went down. And who it was. Now, what I tried to do in my coverage was just one, explain that it wasn't black and white. Okay. It wasn't as much. Udoka made a lot of mistakes. Okay. And there's a lot of things, Justin, that I heard about that I can never write. Okay. That I know are true, but I can't write. Okay. That all that went down in that situation. And I have to pick and choose what to write, what not to write, but approach it as an ethical topic. Like, I used to see Terry Francona hanging out at Del Frisco's. Like, he was a man about town when he was manager of the Sox. And we all know about, or if you guys don't, look it up, John Farrell. And what he was up to, right, was someone, a local media member. And there's been a long tradition of local media members with the Sox, with Sox players. And like, this is nothing new. So, what I try to do is just put a perspective on it that gave a perspective on it that gave a view of why the Celtics did what they did and how women in the organization didn't feel protected, because that was the biggest deal to me. And the Celtics were really put in a terrible spot. Do we announce this? Do we go public? Do we just be quiet? How does an organization that finds out this information, has it thrust on them, how do they handle it? So I didn't try to support anybody, but I tried to explain the situation from all sides. And the fact is that Udoka messed up badly. And I don't think, and people could say, well, it happens all the time, and I get it, but just the circumstances, the witch hunt that went on, where who was it with, and is it, pictures being posted online, women in the organization not feeling protected by the Celtics. angry at all parties, not only Udoka, but the woman involved. Why would you do this to all of us? So I try to give it a different perspective of like, let's look at it ethically, but let's be honest. Like, you know, I heard things about Udoka from the time he got to Boston. Now, they weren't quote unquote unethical, but he's a 45-year-old coach who a lot of women consider good looking. You know, if I had a quarter for every time someone said to me, well, he is very good looking, like women, and it would be like, okay, thanks. he has a life and he's single. Okay. Now, what people thought of his relationship with Nia Long, like all that is very cloudy. So I try to leave that out of it because that's not for me to know. They have their own personal agreements. Whatever happened, happened. But what I try to do is cover these stories from a perspective of like being fair, taking all sides, and then like what probably should have happened. There should have been better communication. There should have been better protection of the women in the Celtics organization. Did the Celtics handle it perfectly? No, but neither did Udoka botched everything. And then, you know, well, why doesn't anything happen to the woman? Because the Celtics are afraid of lawsuits. If you guys, a few years ago, 5 years ago, if y'all, everything hit the fan in Dallas, where the team president was harassing women and approaching women and using his authority to influence women to date them and all that. It got ugly. They hired a new president. And the NBA cleaned house. The Celtics did not want any part of that. So they did what they felt like they had to do. So in that situation, what I try to do is just be fair on all sides, give the perspective that I know, give the information that I've heard that I can write, you know, but it's delicate. It's very delicate. Certain thing I said, I've had people call me and suggest things. I've had people text me out the blue. Or, you know what, like if I can't confirm it or with a few parties, I leave it alone. Some of that stuff is just rumors. You know, there was, she was related to someone it was the wife of a Celtic executive. Like that wasn't. And people were really saying that, was really telling that one. That was one that was like almost believable. But you just have to be careful. And, you know, in this business, guys, like I don't ever stop learning either, right? I think that's why we can relate to young journalists. As veteran journalists, we can want to help them because none of us are perfect. And there's stories I read over that I could have wrote this better. I could have done a better job at this. So this is an ever-evolving business where you learn. You learn more about what to write, what not to write, how to approach things. Sometimes it's just voice inflections. Like I tell young journalists, if someone's had something bad happen to them, you do not use your, hey, how are, like you don't use a certain voice. You don't use your perky voice. You act like you feel, hey, man, you know, if I go to Jason, you know, I'm not, hey, Jason, terrible, you know, Jalen after game 7, you know, you phrase the question to get the best answer because your goal is to get the best answer. Your goal is to get the most information. So you have to approach it a certain way, sometimes not robotically, sometimes very human. To where the person could be like, okay, you kind of feel where I'm coming from, as opposed to like, why did you ask me that? Or why are you coming at me like that? Like, you can't be as robotic. And that's practice and also just kind of reading people. So in situations where like the Udoka story, I just try to tell all sides and also tell the perspective of people who don't have a voice. In this situation, guys, like, the women of the Celtics organization did not have a voice. They weren't, they haven't been allowed to talk. Okay. So what I do try to tell their story because a lot of them felt unprotected.
Thank you. I appreciate you doing that.
Yeah. And I think Gary, to that point, I mean, you have to respect your audience, but also the the people that you're talking about, the people that your story is about. I think that that's a balance that is often missed. I mean, there's just, to your point, like an NBA blog is a dime a dozen, and whether it's aggregated news or primary source reporting, being able to handle things delicately is easier said than done, especially if you don't have, you know, the boots on the ground experience. So we're lucky to have, you know, people like you covering the team, because it's been a complicated few years between COVID, between the Kyrie stuff, some the stuff that Jalen is seeking to do, that's sometimes things that he's still growing, certainly the Udoka stuff. Gary, I have to say, I feel like this entire episode was like a personal masterclass. As a young Celtics reporter, I feel like this was perfect for me. I hope the listeners got something out of it too. So let me close up shop, and then I have one more question for you.
Of course.
So this episode of the Celtics Lab podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the exclusive wagering partner of the CLNS Media Network. We're talking to Gary Washburn of the Boston Globe and the A-List podcast. Gary, it's July 31st. It is the 16th anniversary of the Kevin Garnett trade. So we'll get you out of here on this. Can you give us one Garnett one-off or your favorite Garnett story?
I just always, Kevin's just such a professional, like in terms of his, like he always, I respect it. This is when we're in the locker room. He always knew we had a job to do, you know. Now he didn't act like, now he calls me by my name, but when he covered him, he didn't. But he would get up and he would tap me on the leg, like as a, like, it's, you know, got you, you know, like he would, there was little signals that he knew, and he respected what we did and who we were. And I think that that was always some of the things you get, like you get a guy and you go, like, it's not always getting a guy's cell number in the first day. Sometimes it's just a pat on the shoulder, a pat on the leg, like, hey, you know, like it's subtle things, right? That indications that you're building relationships with these guys. And that should be the goal of young reporters. And it doesn't have to be Jason or Jalen. It could be Sam Hauser or Peyton Pritchard, or if someone young, JD Davidson. Like, no one goes up to that guy and asks him anything. Why not? If he was like, you know, he's got a story. He's from small town Alabama, population 8,000. Like, I think he had 18 people or something in his first summer league game. They all drove from Alabama to Vegas, like, you know, like last year. Like, that's good stuff. Like, the caravan, like, he had people there this year. Like, he, you know, they go to Charlotte. Like, there's so many stories. And it's not only Jason and Jalen and Marcus, but sometimes it's all the way down the roster. So, you know, to me, Garnett was always just a guy who knew he had a job to do. Once he got to respect you, it was good. You know, one time, I can curse. Can I curse?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, one time in New Orleans, he's about to tell his story. All his teammates are waiting. And he's like, I ain't telling it with that light-skinned motherfucker in the room. So I just walked out like, hey, it's team time. It's in the locker room. So he referred to me as light-skinned motherfucker a couple, you know, more than one occasion, which is fine. Okay, I'm light-skinned, you know, whatever. I knew I was out of love. You know, Kevin says a lot worse. I mean, I think everybody gets referred to as some type of expletive. So I thought that was funny. I just thought, okay, that's cool. And I respect that, you know, like I could have been like, I'm not going anywhere. I am allowed in the locker room. You're like, it's like, you know, I was like, man, tell your story. I don't, sometimes you got to know when, you know, you don't want to invade, it's their domain. If they, you know, if he wants to tell a story that he only wants his teammates to hear, I'm not going to sit there and be the stick in the mud, because I'm gonna lose. I'll win the battle and lose the war, right? So I was like, all right, guys, you know, light-skinned motherfuckers exiting. so yeah, like that was some of the stories of covering Garnett. It was a great experience, because by that time, I covered him early in his career, not covered, like a couple of games that he played when I was a young reporter and he first got to the league. And, you know, he was young and rash and all that. This time he was, you know, he was aging down. He was, you know, had been through the war. So his whole approach was just different. And it was more of a elder statesman. And it was great. You know, Paul was different. You know, Paul was a brash guy. So he's still a brash guy. Like, you know,
that's an understatement.
Just ask Dwayne Wade. But and then Ray was a professional of all time. Like, knew you needed, had a job to do, would talk before the games. Kevin never talked before the game until there was like an NBA mandate that every player had to talk before the game, and then they forced Kevin to talk, and he ended up being okay with it. But it was just fast. It felt like you were invading the privacy a little bit when he was, because he's some guys like, I don't want to talk before games, you know. I'll talk to you after the game, which is fine. Like, were you, that's been generations. And then there's Kevin before the game, because the league mandated for, I forgot why, and it, why it stopped, but it was like this one year, I don't know, maybe like 12, 13 or something, where the league was like, all 15 guys have to be available pregame, even Kevin. And he was like, all right, I'll talk, you know. And then we're like, why did you stop talking before a game? Why did you stop talking? He's like, he tells a story about Terry Porter, the veteran point guard who was like on his last leg in Minnesota, telling him, man, you know, treasure your privacy. You know, don't let those dudes ask you stuff before the game. Just be locked in and focused. So he's like, ever since then, my rookie year in Minnesota, I was like, I'm not talking. So that was a good story, you know, like, so yeah, Kevin, obviously amazing trade. And if you guys ever watched the Will Chamberlain doc, good stuff there. Hope the younger generation learns more about Wilt than just be numbers, because Wilt, you see the picture and you see numbers, and you don't know a lot about the guy, because he died in 99 before he could really get his flowers, before social media mm-hmm. took off. Like, you know, it's sad that he didn't live enough. Like, you could say a lot, like, obviously another year anniversary of Bill Russell passing away today. But you could say that Russell living 24 years longer, 23, whatever years longer than Will, was able to get his flowers, get his awards, to see the league hug him and say, we appreciate everything you did. And Wilt never really got that. He got that somewhat, but didn't really got that. He died at 63. So the fact that Kevin's in the direction and telling stories, I think is great.
No, he's so good at it. I mean, I think his first few years with the media was a little raw, and I think he was in a role that didn't suit him, but he's really finding his footing. Yeah, just on the Wilt thing, and then we'll wrap. I always tell my students, just because footage is black and white or a little grainy, you have to get over that, because it's a lot more similar to what you see now than the quality of the video. And whether it's Russell or Wilt, just some of the highlights are timeless. I mean, they're still, I don't know, those plumbers and those dentists could jump pretty high. It seemed like they were pretty athletic guys. All right, Gary Washburn of the Boston Globe, thanks so much for stopping by. And I'm biting my tongue because we ran really long, but now I want to ask you about Derek White's extension. So maybe we'll have you back soon, because I bet you have a take. Until then, Gary, thanks so much. And everyone else, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Adios.
See you.